You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Lisa Boudet toku ingoa, no mai he re mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Hello and welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 25th of July. My name is Lisa Boudet. I will be your host for the day, still covering for our beloved news director Lillian Henley, who's still vacationing in Europe. In studio with me today, Dara Shreet and Harry. How are you guys today?
Good,
oh, sorry. I need to turn on your mics.
Hello.
There you go.
We're good. How are you going?
Good. All right. If I can, coming up on the show today, we've got our usual Dear Science segment with AET's Alan Blackman, and we will be talking about sunscreen and two great female scientists. One is a New Zealand astronomer, and the other one is an English chemist. For our usual segment with the New Zealand First Party, Harry talks to Internal Affairs and Associate Education Minister Tracy Martin. And on Why Worry Week, we have not one but two topics this week. First, we have chosen to replay producer Pearl's little interview with Adam Winstock, a London-based consultant psychiatrist, addiction medicine specialist, and the founder of the Global Drug Survey. And I also spoke with Chris Fowley from the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws about the medicinal cannabis bill. Remember that you can get in touch with us during this show. All you have to do is text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. And now it's time for
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yeah, that's still making Alan smile every single time.
Every time, without
you
fail.
You just love this one. All right, so how are you today, Alan?
I'm very well, thank you, Lisa.
All right. Yeah, how's all good? How are classes going? Been all good?
Oh, they're tough, but we soldier on, so yeah.
All right, all good. Well, let's start the chat then. Mm-hmm. So, some potentially worrying news, actually, for those of us who like to enjoy the sun while being protected from it. I am obviously talking about sunscreen users. Mm-hmm. Tell us a bit more about that.
Okay, well, very, very topical this, because I just went to the doctor this morning and got a little lump checked out just to make sure that it wasn't melanoma, and it wasn't. So, that's all good. Yeah.
That started by worrying me a little bit.
Sorry.
Not sure you would have said it this way, though.
No, indeed. So, sunscreen. So, how do they work and what do they do and everything? We take them for granted. I guess you go out in the sun these days, you have to get covered up in sunscreen. It's just a no-brainer. And, the higher SPF, the better.
Mm.
So, it's kind of interesting because just very, very recently, the governor of Hawaii decided to ban sunscreens that contained particular compounds on the basis that they were not good for coral reefs.
Okay, so has there been a study about this? Or?
Yeah, by all accounts. And that's kind of a worry, really, because, I guess your average person doesn't put that much sunscreen on when they go into the water. You'd have to have a truckload of people there to make a difference, you would have thought, but this is what they've done. So,
okay. Is it specific brands?
Yeah, so there's specific molecules within that do the actual capturing of the UV rays and stop them getting to you. So those molecules have been implicated in damage to coral reefs. And so, better safe than sorry sort of thing. So they are now banning those, and which means that these manufacturers are going to have to look for alternatives in order to, keep selling sunscreens. And sunscreens are quite difficult to get on market, certainly in the States anyway, because they've got to be FDA approved, Federal Drug Administration.
Yeah.
And so therefore, that means that that's an awful lot of time.
Mm.
And of course, with the awful lot of time goes an awful lot of money as well. So, people are looking for alternatives to the so-called man-made, quote-unquote, sunscreens. and so they've started to look to nature for inspiration in this, because it's not only humans that need protection from the sun, it's, everything that's alive as well. So all your plants and animals and all those sorts of things. So how do they...
Nature always has an answer anyway.
Most of the time, yeah. Nature's... mind you, they've had about a 4.5 billion year head start on good old Homo sapiens. Yeah. But... So there's nothing like natural, is there? That's a good word. If you want to sell stuff, you just say it's natural and everything and blah, 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 blah. So plants have one of two ways of essentially stopping ultraviolet rays doing damage to them. And one is sort of a physical barrier. So they use, like on leaves, you'll see a thick waxy sort of cuticle on leaves and stuff.
Okay.
And that acts as a sort of physical barrier to stop the UV radiation getting through. Or you can use sort of organic molecules. Now, if you're not a tree or whatever and got leaves, then you can't use this sort of physical barrier. So there's things like algae and stuff like that that don't have this protective sort of waxy barrier. And so they've got to use organic molecules to absorb the ultraviolet radiation.
Okay.
So in terms of people, again, there's two ways that you can stop UV radiation. So you can use sunscreen, which, you know, is sort of this liquid stuff that you slop all over you, and that's full of these organic molecules that actually absorb the light and or the ultraviolet radiation, which is just light anyway, and render it harmless. Or you can use, again, a physical barrier. So something like titanium dioxide or zinc oxide, so that stuff that you put on your nose, all the cricketers put on their nose and stuff like that. So those are a whole lot of tiny little particles of stuff that actually essentially reflect the ultraviolet light and get it away. And there's been some questions raised over the safety of those as well, for the fact that, yeah, the ultraviolet light might be doing something nasty and you might get these free radicals and stuff. And so I've got a mate at University College London who actually studies this sort of thing, and he won't let his kids anywhere near anything that's got zinc oxide or titanium dioxide. He just does not like those sunscreens at all. He reckons they do more damage than they do good. So we've got these organic molecules. So that's what we want. We want organic molecules going to absorb the radiation and basically render it harmless. So what they are doing is looking at these algae that have got these particular organic molecules in them. They extract these molecules, they have a look at them, look at what the structure is, and then the trick is to now go and put those into sunscreens and call them all natural, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
Brilliant in theory. Trouble is the algae, this particular algae, surprise, surprise, is, well, quite surprising actually, is slow growing, which is not normally what you think of algae. Yeah. They normally sort of, you know.
Well, that's bad luck.
Oh, so they it takes a year to get to the point where you can harvest this stuff. Good question. I didn't swat up on that one.
Come on, Harry.
Is it in Hawaii where they're banning it?
No, it's not. No, it's not Hawaii. I'm pretty sure it's the States, but don't quote me on that.
So what you're saying is that because they're slow growing, it's going to be difficult to use it.
Yeah. So what they've done a little bit of genetic manipulation with these things, and now they can get it in 2 weeks, which is brilliant.
Perfect.
Okay. Of course, you know, the genetic manipulation thing does sort of cause problems amongst some of the public, et cetera. And so what other people are doing are taking those particular molecules and using them sort of as inspiration to design new molecules that will do the job. So these ones that come from the algae, they are difficult to make. They're going to be expensive. They're not going to be commercially viable. So we want cheaper ones that are based on that scaffold, essentially. So they know what bits of the molecules do the job.
And we can just artificially create it.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's based on sort of natural things, but made in the lab. So, you know, it's the next best thing to all natural, quote unquote, I guess. But very, very interesting. I had no idea that really sunscreen did this to coral reefs.
Quite game-changing, really, especially being from New Zealand, where sunscreen is so blasted everywhere.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, we're told from a very early age that you must wear sunscreen.
And again, I mean, if you read Consumer Magazine or whatever, they do sort of periodic tests on sunscreens, and some of them just fail the tests at all. And most of those ones, unfortunately, are ones that are described as being all natural, you know, no chemicals, really? All that crap.
Mm.
you got to be careful. You got to, I guess, sort of take good advice as to what to use and everything. So, yeah.
Well, hopefully that happens in the near future and we can have safe sunscreen for people and the environment.
Here.
How great would that be?
Agreed. Yes.
All right. Moving on to our next topic. It is a New Zealand academic that worked on the aging of galaxies, and she's been sort of forgotten by history.
Yeah, interesting one, this one. Now, I guess this sort of links into the first story in terms of melanoma, as you will see.
Okay.
But what drew me to this was the fact that, just having a quick squiz through the New York Times, as one does, you know, very occasionally, they've got this new series on obituaries of people whose obituary they missed first time around, essentially.
Okay. Oh, it's like they missed the death, and they're like, we should have done something about this.
Basically, yeah, basically, people maybe who weren't famous enough when they died, but whose reputation has sort of increased since they died.
That's a good segment. Yeah. I think that's pretty interesting.
And so one of these was Beatrice Tinsley. And hopefully some listeners might be familiar with that name. So she was a New Zealand raised, not born, but raised physicist who ended up being the first female astronomy professor at Yale University, which is
quite an achievement.
Yeah.
And what sort of time period are we talking?
Well, she was born in 1941.
Okay.
And the folks emigrated out here. She was at a young age, I guess. And so she was schooled in New Plymouth. And went to New Plymouth Girls High, I believe, or something, and was about the only girl who had ever done scholarship physics, I think, at that stage. Then went to Canterbury University and got a master's at Canterbury. Met her husband-to-be there. He was another physics student there. And so Beatrice Hill became Beatrice Tinsley. And then he was employed at Canterbury. She tried to get a job there and couldn't for some reason because her husband was employed there. I don't get that.
Okay,
I don't see
what that would have changed.
Yeah,
but
I know. That does. Well, I mean, this was, I guess, the 60s, I suppose, sort of early to mid 60s. So
it's a shame, though. You know,
well, shame.
If you happen to be two great minds and then only one can get a job.
Then where did she go?
Yeah, shame for New Zealand. So her husband was obviously pretty good because he was headhunted by University of Texas in Dallas.
Not too bad.
And so she went with him, and she decided to do her PhD at that time while he was there. And so she did her PhD at University of Texas at Austin, which is about 700K away from Dallas. So that was a weekly commute sort of thing, or, you know, that was a decent commute. And at that time also, they adopted two kids as well. So she was doing a PhD and sort of, you know,
commuting and then having children.
Yeah.
That's a lot of things.
So, and eventually, so her PhD was all about whether or not the universe was expanding. And nowadays we know that that's a fact, that it's expanding, and it's expanding at ever-increasing speeds, essentially. So back in those days, people thought, okay, there might have been this sort of Big Bang thing, and then the universe will get to a particular size, and then we'll have a thing called the Big Crunch, because it'll all just come in on itself and just sort of turn into that singularity again that it started off at. And some people thought that this sort of happened, you know, infinite number of times and everything. This is the way the universe was. And her PhD thesis showed for a fact that this was not the case. And so,
it's a
pretty
groundbreaking.
Oh, shit, yeah. You know, that's remarkable stuff. And she very publicly took on one of the big astronomers in a public lecture, basically sort of telling the audience that the stuff that they were about to hear was complete bullshit, which is a pretty ballsy thing to do to an academic.
Yeah,
definitely.
But she was right. She was right. It got published, and then the year afterwards, this bigwig came around to her side and said, yep, you're right. And yeah, so, you know, she basically had the world at her feet, really, except for the fact that, again, she couldn't get a job at University of Texas. And so she made what must have been a hell of a gut-wrenching decision to basically leave her family, split up with her hubby, leave the two kids with him, and go and become the first female professor of astronomy at Yale, which, you know, I mean, everyone knows the name Yale. That's a big university.
Yeah.
And, you know, she had to make that choice.
Yeah, family, it's a shame to have to make
family
that
or profession,
choice.
And she chose profession, I guess. And so she got sort of, you know, awards, you know, the best young female physicist on the planet, and et cetera. And then, I guess, a couple of years after she moved to Yale, very tragically, she had found a melanoma on her leg, and she died about 3 years later.
Mm.
And really, really, really tragic story, really. Mm. But she, I guess, is one of New Zealand's unsung heroes to a certain extent, although there is a street in Auckland named after her, out Albany Way.
Is there?
Okay.
And so it very appropriately, it intersects Sir William Pickering Drive. And Sir William Pickering was another great Kiwi scientist who ended up spending all of his time in the States. And Ride Way, I think, was named after Sally Ride, the American female astronaut. Mm. So very appropriately placed street there. So
yeah.
Definitely a woman worth remembering.
Oh, hell yeah. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. No, quite extraordinary. I mean, you know, she was 40 when she died. And, you know, you just
still achieved a lot.
If you're an academic, you're just getting into your best years at that stage. You know, mine are long gone. but, you know.
Don't say that.
But kind of interestingly, and I just looked this up, whatever happened to her husband? And he,
what happened to him?
Yeah, well, he is still a professor at, oh, he's an emeritus professor at Texas still.
Okay.
And he has made enormous contributions into the area of climate change and stuff. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting sort of byproduct of the story and everything. So somebody who should definitely be remembered, you know, a great New Zealand scientist. And, you know, let's do something to commemorate her, I think.
Yeah,
she certainly deserves it.
Thanks for bringing our attention to her.
Yeah, well, thank the New York Times.
Yeah, you know. True. Yeah. I'll start looking into that section actually now.
Yeah, it's very good.
All right, so we only have maybe a couple of minutes to talk about that final topic and this great lady, Rosalind Franklin.
Yes, I know. It's her birthday today.
Yep.
And she would have been 98.
Exactly.
Today. Yes.
So what did she do in her lifetime?
I mean, we can't do this justice in 2 minutes. Goodness me.
Sorry. You're speaking too much.
No, I know. But anyway, okay, so everybody knows Watson and Crick. Well, hopefully everybody knows Watson and Crick are the names that are associated with the structure of DNA.
Yes.
Okay, and they won the Nobel Prize for that in concert with a New Zealand-born guy by the name of Maurice Wilkins. So all three of them won the Nobel Prize for the structure of DNA in physiology or medicine in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a fourth member of the team whose work was absolutely invaluable in determining the structure of DNA, and her name was Rosalind Franklin. And she was what's called an X-ray crystallographer. And long story short, you shoot X-rays at a chemical compound, mm-hmm. a DNA, whatever. And the way that those X-rays bounce off it, you can figure out what the structure is, okay?
Okay.
Down to the atomic resolution, you can figure out what atoms where in a particular molecule, which is just extraordinary. Don't have time to go into that, but... and in those days, it took forever. It took literally years to figure out what was going on with these things. Nowadays, you can do it in 5 minutes on a computer.
Mm.
And she was very slow, very methodical, and she had this really, really good data that she was sort of working through. And then Wilkins and Crick and Watson got a look at her data and they thought, oh, I know what this means. And sort of on the basis of that, they built themselves a physical model of what they thought DNA looked like, and it was proven to be right. Mm. Now, she was very much against this sort of building model stuff. She wanted to work it out sort of herself and get it all sorted and everything, you know, using a brain and not using these models. And so they got the glory. They got the credit.
Yeah.
She unfortunately passed away in 1958 prior to them receiving the Nobel Prize.
And there's now, Nobel Prizes post.
Right. There's no posthumous Nobel Prizes.
Hmm.
Okay. So chances are, had she lived, she surely would have been awarded the Nobel Prize jointly.
With the team, yeah.
With the team. Now, again, the other problem is that you can only get three at once. Okay. So the Nobel Prize. But she would have got it for chemistry or something like that.
Okay.
Right. For surely. And there's a lot of controversy over this particular story, you know, allegations of sexism, allegations of the fact that Watson and Crick and Wilkins sort of stole her data without her knowing. What the truth is anybody's guess.
Yeah.
It does look like her data was shown to Watson and Crick, but then... there's all sorts of stuff. I mean, if you're interested in this, you should certainly go and read the story, because it is a fascinating story. And again, a tragically early death.
Yeah.
You know,
was really, that anything to do with the exposure to X-rays?
To X-rays, very possibly. She died of ovarian cancer. And obviously, too many X-rays around the place, are not too good for you. But again, absolutely astonishing scientist, and one taken far too soon. So, yeah. Sorry, it's a bit morbid today.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Every time you do something about dead people, it's always a bit morbid, which happens more often than not. But it's okay. We still learn a lot of things, so that's all good.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you
for
talking about these people, and we will see you next week.
Surely. Okay.
All right.
See you guys.
Thanks.
See ya.
Now, I'm turning this off. Here we go. we are going to have a little break. And we will be back very shortly.
That was Dear Science.
It will require a minor surgery, but there's nothing to worry about. We're lucky you came in so soon. Okay?
Cool, cool. Yeah. I do have one design question, though. Semi-Permanent 2018, a three-day festival celebrating 15 years as a global leader in creativity and design. More than 50 creative thinkers, artists and designers here to speak and inspire. Semi-Permanent 2018, August 9th to 11th, Aotea Centre, Auckland Central. For tickets and more information, go to semipermanent.com.
Hey, can you grab me some wine glasses?
Yep.
There aren't any.
There's never been a better time to buy glassware. The Glengarry Glassware Sale is on now. New Zealand's biggest range of wine-specific glassware all on special, with up to 65% off brands including Riedel, Aisch, Nachtmann and much more. The Glengarry Glassware Sale starts tomorrow and Sunday, Auckland-wide.
Hey, 95BFM, why are other radio stations so shit?
Because they're all run by Ayn Rand devil creatures.
Oh, you reckon?
Not 95BFM, we're a charity and we make that good, good content you crave with the help of generous people like you.
Me?
By signing up for a Simplicity B-card, you help keep BFM alive, independent and not shit. And as a thank you, you get sweet discounts from some of our mates. Ace. Support independent media from as little as $4.20 a month with a Simplicity B card. Go to 95bfm.com/sign up.
Now it's time for Jenny Marcroft from the New Zealand First Party.
Hello there. After a month or so hiatus, we return to our New Zealand First segment. This week, speaking not with Jenny Marcroft, but with Tracy Martin, Minister for Internal Affairs and Associate Minister of Education. This morning, we touched on the inquiry into the State Services Commission appointment of the Deputy Police Commissioner, Wally Haumaha, and also we talked about New Zealand First turning 25 years old.
Hi, Harry. How are you?
Very good. How are you going this morning?
Not too bad. Thank you very much.
It's very good to hear. So I thought we could start off this morning talking about the inquiry into the State Service Commission appointment process of the Deputy Commissioner of Police, Wally Haumaha. Mm-hmm. So a few days ago, you did announce the terms of the reference. I was hoping you could just start off by telling me a little bit about the purpose of the inquiry. What will the terms of reference be focusing on here?
Sure. So mostly this is about the process. At the end of the day, what we're asking Dr. Pauline Kingi to do is to go away and have a look at the process and come back with an answer for us around what is the information that the State Services Commission should be expected to provide? What is the level of information that the State Services Commission should realistically be able to find out? Mm-hmm. What information should be given to a minister along with any other recommendations around appointment? And if there is a filtering mechanism, what is it and why is it? So really, this particular inquiry is around the process that led to a particular appointment.
I mean, it's clear that there's been some issue that's happened. I mean, whether or not it was that the minister was told about Haumaha's previous comments. I mean, do you think that it's likely someone is going to be losing their job here?
I don't really know. I don't want to preempt what is the Dr. Pauline Kingi's inquiry. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we've made it an independent government inquiry, is mm-hmm. so that, you know, there can be no suggestion that politicians are getting into this and trying to muck it about, which is what has been suggested by the opposition. So, you know, we specifically have made it an independent inquiry. A person who's not, I don't think, could be criticised in any way, shape or form for her skills or her work ethic.
Mm. Tell me about her, Pauline Kingi. Why did you select her to lead the inquiry?
Well, Ms. Kingi, apart from being, you know, highly respected for the career that she has had, she's an incredibly smart woman who did her degrees and so on at Harvard. She's highly recognised both inside of the Māori world and inside the sort of the Pākehā world. She's known to be a very tough operator, so she doesn't get pushed around by people. And I think that's what we needed here. We need a person who has, because this is a six-week inquiry, so it's a very condensed period of time. We understand the public interest. And so she, you know, the chair needed to get in there, ask the questions, not be frightened to go and ask some hard questions of some people quite high up in the State Services Commission and get answers for us.
Do you think it's likely she will be pushed around a little bit?
No, I don't. Not with this particular chair, no.
Okay. I mean, looking at what the National Party have been saying, do you think that they're valid
in their claims that so they said there's a conflict of interest in your appointment to the head of the inquiry as a New Zealand First MP and Wally himself, who put his hand up for New Zealand First candidacy in 2005.
Has somebody proven that, have they?
I think that there were clippings from a New Zealand Herald article that showed he was running for Rotorua seat.
So when something appears in the newspaper, are we assuming that it's true? I've seen many things attributed to me, or I've been at many incidents that I've then seen, events that I've then seen reported, that there is very little correlation between what I experienced and what has ended up in the paper.
Right.
So that's the first thing. I mean, I don't know. I think it's something we teach our young people quite a lot, is actually verify from three different sources a piece of information before you decide that it's real. In my long experience with New Zealand First, I have never been aware that Mr. Homaha had anything to do with New Zealand First. So that was news to me.
Right, right. And is that the general consensus across New Zealand First?
Well, I don't know. I, as a minister who was required by the cabinet to appoint an independent chair of an independent government inquiry, I didn't go and canvass New Zealand First because that's not what I'm here to do.
Right.
If we go back to the opposition statements so they've made several statements. Let's just remember that this is a opposition that gave the gentleman that they are criticising two awards. So they gave him some of the highest honours in New Zealand. And so they need to, I think they need to be a little bit circumspect there.
Mm-hmm.
But with regard to whether we've taken too long to put this inquiry together or not, it took 15 days to actually, from the moment we said we would have an independent government inquiry to the process that I had to take with the Department of Internal Affairs to find a chair that would drop everything in their lives and dedicate themselves to 6 weeks to finding out the information we need from this inquiry. And, people do have lives. So it took 15 days, I think, to put it together,
So you'd say that the National Party statements are probably quite political?
Oh, they are political. I mean, they're the opposition, and that's okay. So, I mean, I understand it, but I just think that they need to be a little bit careful that they don't also look somewhat hypocritical.
Right. Okay. All right, moving on. New Zealand First did hit a 25-year anniversary mark, which is quite impressive. So they're now New Zealand's third longest surviving party.
I know.
Would you say that now New Zealand First is at the strongest it's ever been?
I think we are. I mean, I think we are from the perspective that, every new political party, and you've seen them, it's hard to get traction, and it's hard to actually make sure that you keep your profile up in a country that is, strangely enough, still trying to figure out the difference between first past the post and MMP. And I make that statement because how many times are we seeing in the paper that this is a Labour-led government? Whereas actually it's a coalition government. We're not following Labour. We are collegially sitting down at a cabinet table with them and coordinating with Labour's supply and confidence partner, the Greens, to come up with policy and legislation for what we believe is the better direction for New Zealand. But the media still can't figure that out, that this is actually an MMP environment. It's probably the first truly MMP government.
Reflecting on New Zealand First, do you think in terms of policy and what the party stands for, do you think that much has changed over the last 25 years?
Well, the 15 founding principles are still there.
Mm-hmm.
And we still, I know, for example, when we get to contentious issues where what I like about my caucus is we don't all come from just this one philosophical bent, okay? So I know when we have had contentious issues that we've had extreme right views expressed, extreme left, and, there's a whole lot of us in the middle. So because we don't just come from one particular narrative, we go back to our 15 founding principles quite often to say, well, okay, what would the people who voted for us want us to do based on the values that we, we have stood for? So those founding principles are still as valid today as they were 25 years ago.
Do you think having some in the caucus who are a little bit more right-leaning, some who are a little bit left-leaning, that can be a bit confusing for the voters?
No, because what it does is, we stand for the policies. So what it does is it actually means that we get, we're more reflective of New Zealand, I personally think. We don't, of all New Zealand. because we sit down there and we thrash out what is actually the best reasonable, responsible decision for New Zealand with all those views sitting at the table. I really like the fact that we have those strong conversations and get to a consensus decision phase, you know, which is a little bit different from the dictatorship I'm supposed to be working in.
seeing the party strong, I mean, one day Winston Peters will have to call it quits. Do you think now is as good a time as ever for him to leave confidently with the party able to thrive? I mean, looking at other New Zealand parties, for example, when Richard Preble resigned from ACT, it took a really great leader in Hyde to sort of to keep the party going.
A really great,
leader. I mean, a personality, definitely a personality.
Definitely a personality. Now that's something.
Do you think that New Zealand First needs something like that?
Well, this is the thing, because I actually had Henry Cook from the media ask me about who would be the next leader, because a leader needs to get media attention, needs to be a character, and so on and so forth. Really? Is that what a leader needs to be? I would say to you that a leader needs to be a person who can bring people together, who has the ability to take people along with decisions with them, to be able to interact intelligently with a vast variety of different members of New Zealand society. So
I think in the current political landscape it takes a bit of both.
Well, I think we're getting into personality politics. We have started to, and the media has driven that. They started to drive like presidential campaigns. So it started slightly with Helen Clark, and then it really accelerated under John Key, that this became about personality. And for some bizarre reason, nobody considers that. Tell me, if Simon Bridges went tomorrow, who would replace him?
Exactly. Well, I mean, I think in the National Party there are a few strong personalities.
Don't think there are that in New Zealand First?
No, I think I would disagree. I mean, I think yourself would be a contender for leadership in New Zealand First. I mean, I think there are some great leaders at the moment.
We've got depth. I think, Harry, is we've built depth over the last 25 years, definitely.
Yeah, so what do you think lies in the future of New Zealand First politically?
I think more of the same. I think what's happened, and this is why I'm really, really pleased for the Right Honourable Winston Peters. The reason he was expelled from the National Party all those years ago was that he didn't believe in the neoliberal policies that they campaigned against and then continued. And so he was actually expelled from the National Party because he wouldn't do those policies that were harming his country. This government, and being part of this government, has given him the chance that we've been working for 25 years to turn us away from that the money is the god and that we actually care about our people. So I think that from a New Zealand First perspective, we've finally got to the place in this nation that what we've been talking about, putting people first, is actually starting to resonate with the public. And if we can prove it over the next 3 years, then I think that we have a strong future actually in government.
Just finally as well, we're going to touch on you're creating a Disability and Learning Support Action Plan as Associate Education Minister. What sparked the need for this plan here?
Well, actually, we've had a crisis in the support that we've been able to give our students with disability and learning support needs for a long time in this country, so it hasn't been working. So if you think about students with high physical needs, they've had to fight, their parents have had to fight consistently against a system to prove that their children are bad enough to get some sort of help inside of school. And then on another level, if you've got students with dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, they've had no support whatsoever, even when they have gone and got a $2,000 diagnosis. So what I'm doing is rebuilding the whole structure of the system. I'm taking it to Cabinet within the month, and then it'll come out for targeted consultation. It's been created with 5,000 voices of parents and students. And we're going to change this. We're going to remove the silos of money. We're going to put one point of contact for our parents and our students and our teachers who need support inside the classroom. And we're going to start breaking down those silos that parents have had to smash their heads up against for ages.
We've been speaking with Jenny Marcroft from the New Zealand First Party.
The Wire.
Again, not Jenny Markgraf this week, but Tracy Martin talking to producer Harry Willis today. Now, before we move on to talking about substance use and abuse and legislation related to that for Why You Worry Week, we'll just have this small little second break.
You love music, right?
Yes, yes, I do.
Then drive your stake into the musical landscape by voting for the 95 BFM Top 10.
But how?
Text the word VOTE and your chosen band's name to 53955 or vote online at 95bfm.com/top10 before 6pm every Wednesday. Then join Pearl from 7pm as she starts counting them down. The 95BFM Top 10 with your host Pearl, Wednesday night 7 till 9 and always online at 95bfm.com.
It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki, your saying of the week. This week,
E Kira. Is that right?
Mate, have you seen the new Munchie Mart? It's flash, as.
E Kira, girl. E Kira. Is that right? It's your Kiwaha o Te Wiki. Brought to you by Ngā Tauira Māori, the University of Auckland Māori Students Association.
The Wire.
What are you even worried about? It's Worry Week on The Wire.
Yes, it is. This week our theme on Why Worry Week is substance use abuse legislation and policy. Today we have not one but two stories to share. The first one is about the Global Drug Survey, largest of its kind in the world. Research seeks information about people's experiences of drug use, regardless of the legal status of the substance, so that data can be collected and shared with the public. 95BFM reporter Pearl spoke with Adam Winstock, a London-based consultant psychiatrist, addiction medicine specialist, and the founder of the Global Drug Survey, about what he hopes to achieve with the research project. She began by asking Adam about the changes that have come out of the data over the 6 years since the survey's conception.
So the Global Drug Survey is the biggest drug survey in the world, and we're now in year six. And basically it works by us partnering with a whole huge media organisations around the world who promote our survey in 10 different languages for about 6 weeks at the end of every year. And we then share that data with the media organisations and the rest of the world a few months later, normally in May, June of each year. And we tell people what's going on with the world of drugs. And I guess what's different about the Global Drug Survey compared to most drug surveys is that we're not funded by government. We're not obsessed by drug-related harm. Our mission is to help people who choose to use drugs do so more safely. And we ask things that are interesting to people who use drugs. And it's interesting. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were lucky. We started really just as the world of drugs was about to change forever. So I think the three big things that we've been able to track has been, one, the appearance of darknet markets, so kind of Silk Road and people being able to access good quality drugs online without going through street dealers. And the work we've shown is that more and more people are buying drugs on the dark net each year. And that really, whether or not people buy drugs on the dark net reflects the kind of country's drug policy. So, for example, in Sweden and Norway, huge numbers of people will buy drugs on the dark net compared to really low numbers in a country where, like Portugal, where you can just buy drugs on the street. Interestingly, New Zealand has relatively low levels of buying drugs on the dark net, and I think that's because you've got such tight borders and you've got such a strong working relationship between your police and your postal service. Mm. I mean, trying to get anything into New Zealand is nigh on impossible. I arrived for a conference in New Zealand 10 years ago with an apple in my bag, and I'd only come over from Sydney, and I got fined $200. The second big change would obviously be the huge increase in the number of new drugs that have been notified around the world. And we've been tracking the appearance and impact of drugs like synthetic cannabis products for the last 5 or 6 years. And I think one of the biggest findings that we've been able to share is that synthetic cannabis products, which were obviously huge in New Zealand, just aren't nice. The risk of turning up to an emergency department on synthetic cannabis products is at least 30 times higher than natural high-potency cannabis. The risk of you running into problems like dependence and withdrawal is way higher. So if I look at what New Zealand did with its, you know, attempts at regulation, it was such a brave thing to do, but I think, damn, you probably tried to regulate the wrong drug.
Yeah.
So that would be the second thing. And I guess the third thing, and it probably hasn't hit New Zealand in the same way, is that huge reemergence of high-quality MDMA and high-dose MDMA pills, which has caused lots of problems across Europe and the UK, where people are ending up taking way too much. And the reason I guess I say that probably hasn't hit New Zealand is one of the things New Zealand tops the global drug survey in every single year is you have the most expensive cocaine and MDMA in the world by a factor of at least five.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it also, I've read a lot of stuff about New Zealand's, you know, sort of drug use and thing. And I think also for us, it's like, you know, like it's a geographical thing. We're so, so far away from the sort of hubs of those sort of drugs that it's A, impossible to get anything through our border security because of our biosecurity, because of our environment and stuff. But also just the sheer, you know, transportation of covering that much mileage to even get here is ridiculous. And I mean, we're such a small population that I don't think, you know, people are, it's kind of a hard thing to say.
It's not worth the effort.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not worth the effort for a cocaine dealing ring. You're absolutely right. But the consequence of that is that New Zealand has a couple of problems that you don't see elsewhere. So, you know, the best source of quality pharmaceuticals are prescription drugs for many people in Australia, which is why we see, you know, high rates of prescription opioid misuse, tramadol use, benzo use, and why we also see lots of people cooking up their own sorts of drugs, whether that's home-baked crystal meth or things like poppy tea. So I think New Zealand's geographical isolation protects it from some things, but increases its use of other substances. I mean, people use what's available.
Mm.
And, of course, there's alcohol and weed.
Are there specific objectives in each survey that you put out in terms of what you want to know? Are you adapting the survey every year?
Yeah, so there's like a core bit of the survey that looks at prices and purchases, kind of who ends up in A&E and things. And then every year we look at kind of bits and pieces that are really, I know, kind of like just particularly interesting that year. So this year, the four things that we're focusing on in the specialist section. So when you get through the first 20 minutes or so, you get kind of given a selection of other things. And this year we're looking at cannabis legalization. So we're asking cannabis users around the world, how would you actually want to see cannabis regulated in your country? And that's really important because no one asks real experts. So that's one. Two, we're going to look at cannabis as medicine in the real world. So if you're using it, what condition, what do you use, how often do you use, how effective is it, do you have any side effects? The third thing is drug vaping. So everyone seems to think that the only drugs you can vape is kind of nicotine and cannabis. That's not the case. And so we're looking at other drugs that people are using. And then the fourth thing is we've got a lovely little section on psychedelics. So we're looking at the whole issue of people microdosing with LSD and magic mushrooms to improve creativity and work performance. We're looking at people's use of ayahuasca. And finally, we're trying to understand what people mean when they say they have a bad trip. Because psychedelics get a bad name because of this idea of a bad trip. And the truth is there is a big difference between someone having a difficult experience when taking a psychedelic and having a bad trip. And part of the reason people are exploring psychedelics as treatments for difficult emotional conditions like depression or PTSD is that it can allow people to process difficult emotions in a way that ultimately can allow for transformation and growth. So we're working with some psychedelic expert groups to try and understand what people mean when they talk about difficult or bad. So yeah, that will be really interesting stuff.
And I think, I mean, I guess this is so broad, but what would you like to see be done either, you know, domestically in the UK, in New Zealand or globally to sort of reduce drug harm? What do you think are sort of the key things that need to happen?
I think it's just kind of honesty is the best policy, you know? And so the first thing I would want to see, and this is on the back of a big nightclub in London called Fabric having been closed down because of MDMA-related deaths and recently being allowed to reopen, but with really punitive kind of rules, you know, effectively going zero tolerance for drugs. And actually what I'd like to see is legislation from the police and licensing that would be applicable to nightclubs, pubs, people who run festivals. And the legislation would be, if you are going to run a large event where there are people here drinking and likely to take drugs, it is mandatory for you to have information on your website about how to use drugs more safely. And you will have your staff not just trained in responsible service of alcohol, you will have your staff trained in how to recognize and respond to risk-related drugs. And that should be put down in law. So instead of the current situation, where if a promoter or a bar owner phones up local police and says, you know what, I think I might have a bit of a problem with coke in my club, they'll lose their license, they get shut down.
Yeah.
What you have is a different situation. And the reason that's so important is there's lots of good places to get really good information about drugs. Global Drug Survey, Aeroid, Blue Light, Tripsit, whatever. But lots of people don't bother.
Mm.
And if you had all of that information there on all the big kind of club websites, promoter websites, venue websites, people would go, I'm waiting for 2 minutes for my ticket to download or whatever. I'm going to get a little bit of information. That's kind of what I'd like to see. And I think I'd just like to see governments being a little bit more honest. I understand changing drug laws is difficult. It's politically a bit risky. You know, there can be some backlash. But at least governments could go, look, even though drugs are illegal at the moment and we're looking at how things might change, we want to protect people. And so what we're now happy to do is start having an honest dialogue with you. So we, you know, the reason we don't want young people doing drugs is because the brain's developing and they're more vulnerable to harm. You know, the reason we don't want people smoking weed every day is that, you know, 10% of people get dependent and, you know, it can kind of reduce the potential in your life and make you emotionally distant. But if you smoke weed every now and then on a Friday, hey, probably not that much of a problem. If you've got a mental illness, it's a bit of a difference.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Remember that you can text us on 5395 or give us a call in studio on 309-3879. I'm reminding you of that because we just got a text from someone saying, drugs are too expensive. How can we bring the price down? I don't think that is the point, but who knows? So, second story of the week for Wire Worry Week, and I am talking about the medicinal cannabis bill. So while the Health Select Committee is finalising its report on this government bill, as we speak, the National Party has announced its intention to drop its support, instead putting a members' bill in the ballot under MP Shane Reddy's name. National Party leader Simon Bridges said he would not support an unthought-through bill, even though the opposition stood for the government bill in its first reading. So I talked to Chris Fowley, the spokesperson of the National Organisation for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, and asked whether he was surprised by national support withdrawal and what it meant for the future.
Well, the National Party have expressed concerns around the lack of detail in the bill since its first reading, but they did say during that debate in Parliament that they were going to work constructively with the government to make it better and to improve safe access to patients. So I think it's not a surprise that they want to make some changes. I think a lot of patients want to make changes to that bill as well. But we think that this is just, you know, with the aim of playing politics. You know, they're playing with people's lives here. And our main concern is that time is of the essence, that we've already had almost a year go by talking about this bill. It only creates an exemption for people with 12 months to live. It's not due to actually come into effect until 2020. And if they tinker more with it or put up another private members bill, I mean, there's not even a guarantee that a private members bill will even be drawn. So if they withdraw their support for this bill and then put up a private members bill, well, that can just sit there in the ballot forever. It may never be drawn. So what we're urging is that the National Party and the government get together and find a workable compromise that they can all agree with and put the interests of patients first.
So do you not think that the bill could just pass without national support?
Oh, it will. It's a government bill. But, you know, they could meddle. I mean, who knows, right? Who knows where they're coming from? If they're coming from a position of wanting to help patients, then get on with it and help patients.
Are you satisfied fully with the bill?
Well, the bill does need some changes, and we'll know today what those are going to be because the Health Committee are sitting down right now to go over the report and the recommendations from officials, and then that will be tabled in Parliament tomorrow
with the recommendations for changes that the government is willing to accept. And of course, if the National Party then come up with their bill and there's some good ideas in there, and there could well be, then the government is able to adopt those as what's called a supplementary order paper in the next stage of proceedings. And that would actually be a really good way of the government calling the bluff of the National Party, who may put up a bill, you know, never intending for it to be drawn, but for it to just sit there as a political tool. Well, the government can put those clauses in a supplementary order paper and challenge the National Party to vote for them.
What kind of concerns do you have with the current bill?
Well, firstly, we feel that the exemption for terminal patients, which of course is very important, you need that exemption while we work out how the products are going to be made and sold and things, that exemption is not wide enough. It needs to be extended to people with chronic pain and other severe and debilitating conditions. That's actually the term that is used to access controlled drugs under our existing scheme as a severe or debilitating condition. So it makes no sense to further qualify that as terminal. How do you even judge that? But, you know, there are people suffering that are not terminal, but that will be in pain every day for the rest of their lives, and they don't qualify under that. So that needs to change. The other thing is that the definition of CBD, of cannabidiol, that they have in the bill is quite narrow, and it restricts it to only a few available products in the world that are very expensive. So that doesn't seem to be a great step forward. That could easily be amended to allow health supplement type products like are commonly available in Europe and North America. And thirdly, the rules around the setting up domestic cultivation, they're just not in the bill. And I think that's the big concern that the National Party have, that the government is intending to do that through regulation. At some later date, we don't know what shape those regulations will have or how long they will take. And what's really been concerning us over the past 6 months or so is a lack of resourcing in the Ministry of Health to develop that. They don't appear to have all the skills necessary in-house in terms of expertise of how these schemes have been rolled out elsewhere in the world, and they don't have any additional resourcing allocated for them to get that expertise and advice.
Would you still like the bill to pass its second reading, even taking into consideration these flaws?
Oh, absolutely. And I'm sure that it will come back from committee with some improvements. Those were our concerns with the bill, how it was when it went into committee.
Yeah.
I'm sure that today that they will have heeded that. They heard from hundreds of patients and experts from all around New Zealand. I'm sure that there will be some changes and improvements. And this is where the National Party should be making their improvements rather than throwing their toys out of the cot and having a sulk and threatening to have their own bill. Instead, they should be working with the government to make that bill better.
There's also been a very recent poll from the New Zealand Drug Foundation that I'm sure you're pleased with the outcome, which is that 87% of the people that were surveyed are in favour of allowing medicinal cannabis for chronic pain relief, amongst other findings. Like I said, yeah, I think it's something that you will be happy about.
Oh, absolutely. And the key thing from that poll, because they asked a bunch of different questions, I think eight or ten different questions, and the key takeaway from that poll was that every single question showed an increase in support over the previous year. And as we know from polling, the subtle ways that you word questions can have a big effect. So if you use one word or a different word, it can really influence the outcome. So, but the key trend here is that no matter what wording they used, every single question had an increase in support.
Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I think the other key, the big thing that's bubbling away at the moment is the referendum. We've got some more progress on that, where the governing parties are currently consulting each other on three key issues, and that's what should the question be, what should the timing be, should it be during the local body election, the general election, or some other period in between? And should it be binding or not? So none of those things have been decided yet. Anything that people have read to the contrary is rumour and supposition at this point. So it's really important people get in contact with their MPs, particularly ones from the governing parties, and give them the answers to those three questions. What should the question be? When should the referendum be run? And should it be binding? And of course it should be binding. I think that's a given. But they need a bit of pressure to commit to that.
What about what's your organisation's preference in terms of what should the question be?
Well, we actually think it would be really useful to break it down into two or three questions. And again, like what I was saying before, the wording can have a big difference. So it's really important that we have a public education campaign leading into that, that really gets through those myths and gives people a really good understanding of what exactly we're talking about. Like if you throw around the words decriminalise and legalise, they essentially mean the same thing, but to a lot of people they mean completely different things.
Yeah.
And they'll say, I support decrim, but never legalisation, not realising they actually mean the same thing. So that's really important. But we think a really useful starting point for a referendum would be to ask simply, should adults be allowed to use cannabis? Should adults be allowed to grow their own cannabis? And should adults be allowed to purchase cannabis? And those three questions, if we had those three, I think you'd get a really good indication of where the public is sitting. But they're not confusing. You know exactly what those questions mean. You don't have to work it out. Like, what does legalize even mean? If we word it really simply, like I just said, I think you'll get a really honest answer to those questions. The law that's going through, hopefully that will take care of medicinal. If it doesn't, and there are patients that are not covered by that law, then obvious, which you know we would fully expect, then obviously that will have an impact on the referendum, because people might be thinking, well, if I vote yes to this referendum, that's a way of taking care of all those patients that aren't covered by the law. By the medical cannabis law.
Yeah.
So they will relate to each other to an extent, but I think we do need to keep them separate to an extent so that we can have clarity of our thoughts around that. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting next year or so. We don't want the government to particularly rush into the referendum and do it as soon as possible, because we need to have that public education campaign and a really wide-ranging debate about all these issues.
Worry Week on The Wire.
Indeed, that was Wire Worry Week with two topics this week, and I hope some food for thoughts. That brings us to the end of our show for another week. Big thank you to all of those who spoke with us on the show today. That is Alan Blackman, Tracy Martin, Adam Winstock, and Chris Fowley. A big thank you to my producers today, Pearl and Harry, and obviously thank you to the listeners for tuning in. That's all for us today. Bridges up next with the 1 to 4. You're listening to 95 BFM.
That was The Wire.